Chapter 17. Sunned himself in her scornfulness, as if it were love, and his ears drank in her curt monosyllables, as though they were rhapsodies of endearment. Strangely enough, the coldness with which she treated her foreigner began to be the conduct of Lord Isenway towards herself. It was a matter of great anxiety to him that there should be a lineal successor to the title, yet no sign of that successor appeared. One day he complained to her quite roughly of his fate. "All will go to that dolt of a cousin. ," he cried. "I'd sooner see my name and place at the bottom of the sea." ," the lady soothed him, and fell into thought, and did not recriminate. But one day, soon after, she went down to the cottage of the gardener, to inquire how he was getting on, for he had been ailing of late, though, as was supposed, not seriously. Though she often visited the poor, as he had never entered her under gardener's home before, and was much surprised, even grieved and dismayed to find that he was too ill to rise from his bed. She went back to her mansion, and returned with some delicate soup, that she might have a reason for seeing him. His condition was so feeble and alarming, and his face so thin, that it quite shocked her softening heart, and gazing upon him she said, "You must get well, you must. I have been hard with you, I know it. I will not be so again." ," the sick and dying man, for he was dying indeed, took her hand, and pressed it to his lips. "Too late, my darling, too late," he murmured. "But you must not die. Oh, you must not," she said. And on an impulse she bent down, and whispered some words to him, blushing as he had blushed in her maiden days. He replied by a faint wan smile. "Time was, but that's past," he said. "I must die." And die he did, a few days later, as the sun was going down behind the garden wall. Her harshness seemed to come trebly home to her then, and she remorsefully exclaimed against herself in secret and alone. Her one desire now was to erect some tribute to his memory, without its being recognized as her handiwork. In the completion of this scheme there arrived a few months later a handsome stained glass window for the church, and when it was unpacked, and in course of erection Lord Isenway strolled into the building with his wife. Erected to his memory by his grieving widow, he said, reading the legend on the glass, "I didn't know that he had a wife. I've never seen her." "Oh yes, you must have, Isenway. Only you forget," replied his lady blandly. "But she didn't live with him, and was seldom seen visiting him, because there were differences between them, which, as is usually the case, makes her all the more sorry now." And go ruining herself by this expensive ruby and azure glass design. She is not poor, they say. As Lord Isenway grew older he became crustier and crustier, and whenever he set eyes on his wife's boy by her other husband he would burst out morosely, saying, "'Tis a very odd thing, my lady, that you could oblige your first husband, and couldn't oblige me." "Ah, if I had only thought of it sooner!" she murmured. "What?" said he. "Nothing, dearest," replied Lady Isenway. The colonel was the first to comment upon the churchwarden's tale by saying that the fate of the poor fellow was rather a hard one. The gentleman tradesman could not see that his fate was at all too hard for him. He was legally nothing to her, and he had served her shamefully. If he had been really her husband it would have stood differently. The bookworm remarked that Lord Isenway seemed to have been a very unsuspicious man, with which view a fat member with a crimson face agreed. It was true his wife was a very close-mouthed personage, which made a difference. If as he had spoken out recklessly her lord might have been suspicious enough, as in the case of that lady who lived at Stapleford Park in their great-grandfather's time. Though there, to be sure, considerations arose which made her husband view matters with much philosophy. A few of the members, doubted the possibility of this. The Crimson Man, who was a retired maltster of comfortable means, ventru, and short in stature, cleared his throat, blew off his superfluous breath, and proceeded to give the instance before alluded to of such possibility, first apologizing for his heroine's lack of a title, it never having been his good fortune to know many of the nobility. To his style of narrative the following is only an approximation. Dame the Sixth. Squire Petrick's lady by the Crimson Maltster, folk who are at all acquainted with the traditions of Stapleford Park, will not need to be told that in the middle of the last century it was owned by that trump of mortgagees, Timothy Petrick, whose skill in gaining possession of fair estates, by granting sums of money on their title deeds has seldom, if ever been equaled in our part of England. Timothy was a lawyer by profession, and agent to several noblemen, by which means his special line of business became open to him by a sort of revelation. It is said that a relative of his, a very deep thinker, who afterwards had the misfortune to be transported for life for mistaken notions on the signing of a will, taught him considerable legal lore, which he creditably resolved never to throw away for the benefit of other people, but to reserve it entirely for his own. However, I have nothing in particular to say about his early and active days, but rather of the time when, an old man, he had become the owner of vast estates by the means I have signified, among them the great manor of Stapleford, on which he lived, in the splendid old mansion now pulled down. Likewise estates at Marlott, estates near Sherton Abbas, nearly all the borough of Millpool, and many properties near Ivell. Indeed, I can't call to mind half his landed possessions, and I don't know that it matters much at this time of day, seeing that he's been dead and gone many years. It is said that when he bought an estate he would not decide to pay the price till he had walked over every single acre with his own 2 feet, and prodded the soil at every point with his own spud, to test its quality, which, if we regard the extent of his properties, must have been a stiff business for him. At the time I am speaking of he was a man over 80, and his son was dead. But he had 2 grandsons, the eldest of whom, his namesake, was married, and was shortly expecting issue. Just then the grandfather was taken ill for death, as it seemed, considering his age. By his will the old man had created an entail, as I believe the lawyers call it, devising the whole of the estates to his elder grandson and his issue male, failing which, to his younger grandson and his issue male, failing which, to remoter relatives, who need not be mentioned now. While old Timothy Petrick was lying ill, his elder grandson's wife, Annetta, gave birth to her expected child, who, as fortune would have it, was a son. Timothy, her husband, though sprung of a scheming family, was no great schemer himself. He was the single one of the Petricks then living whose heart had ever been greatly moved by sentiments which did not run in the groove of ambition. And on this account he had not married well, as the saying is, his wife having been the daughter of a family of no better beginnings than his own. That is to say, her father was a country townsman of the professional class. But she was a very pretty woman, by all accounts, and her husband had seen, courted, and married her in a high tide of infatuation, after a very short acquaintance, and with very little knowledge of her heart's history. He had never found reason to regret his choice as yet, and his anxiety for her recovery was great. She was supposed to be out of danger, and herself and the child progressing well, when there was a change for the worse, and she sank so rapidly that she was soon given over. When she felt that she was about to leave him, Annetta sent for her husband, and, on his speedy entry and assurance that they were alone, she made him solemnly vow to give the child every care in any circumstances that might arise, if it should please heaven to take her. This, of course, he readily promised. Then, after some hesitation, she told him that she could not die with a falsehood upon her soul, and dire deceit in her life. She must make a terrible confession to him before her lips were sealed forever. She thereupon related an incident concerning the baby's parentage, which was not as he supposed. Timothy Petrick, though a quick-feeling man, was not of a sort to show nerves outwardly, and he bore himself as heroically as he possibly could do in this trying moment of his life. That same night his wife died, and while she lay dead, and before her funeral, he hastened to the bedside of his sick grandfather, and revealed to him all that had happened. The baby's birth, his wife's confession, and her death, beseeching the aged man, as he loved him, to bestir himself now, at the 11th hour, and alter his will so, as to dish the intruder. Old Timothy, seeing matters in the same light as his grandson, required no urging against allowing anything to stand in the way of legitimate inheritance. He executed another will, limiting the entail to Timothy his grandson, for life, and his male heirs thereafter to be born, after them to his other grandson Edward, and Edward's heirs. Thus the newly born infant, who had been the center of so many hopes, was cut off and scorned as none of the elect. The old mortgagee lived, but a short time after this, the excitement of the discovery having told upon him considerably, and he was gathered to his fathers like the most charitable man in his neighborhood. Both wife and grandparent being buried, Timothy settled down to his usual life as well as he was able, mentally satisfied that he had by prompt action defeated the consequences of such dire domestic treachery as had been shown towards him, and resolving to marry a second time, as soon as he could satisfy himself in the choice of a wife. But men do not always know themselves. The embittered state of Timothy Petrick's mind bred in him by degrees such a hatred and mistrust of womankind that, though several specimens of high attractiveness came under his eyes, he could not bring himself to the point of proposing marriage. He dreaded to take up the position of husband a second time, discerning a trap in every petticoat, and a slough of destined impossible heirs. What has happened once, when all seemed so fair, may happen again, apostrophe he said to himself. I'll risk my name no more. So he abstained from marriage, and overcame his wish for a lineal descendant to follow him in the ownership of Stapleford. Timothy had scarcely noticed the unfortunate child that his wife had borne, after arranging for a meager fulfillment of his promise to her to take care of the boy, by having him brought up in his house. Occasionally, remembering this promise, he went and glanced at the child, saw that he was doing well, gave a few special directions, and again went his solitary way. Thus he and the child lived on in the Stapleford mansion house till 2 or 3 years had passed by. One day he was walking in the garden, and by some accident left his snuff box on a bench. When he came back to find it, he saw the little boy standing there. He had escaped his nurse, and was making a plaything of the box, in spite of the convulsive sneezings which the game brought in its train. Then the man with the encrusted heart became interested in the little fellow's persistence in his play under such discomforts. He looked in the child's face, saw there his wife's countenance, though he did not see his own, and fell into thought on the piteousness of childhood, particularly of despised and rejected childhood, like this before him. From that hour, try as he would to counteract the feeling, the human necessity to love something or other got the better of what he had called his wisdom, and shaped itself in a tender anxiety for the youngster Rupert. This name had been given him by his dying mother when, at her request, the child was baptized in her chamber, lest he should not survive for public baptism, and her husband had never thought of it as a name of any significance till, about this time, he learned by accident that it was the name of the young Marquis of Christminster, son of the Duke of Southwesterland, for whom Annetta had cherished warm feelings before her marriage. Recollecting some wandering phrases in his wife's last words, which he had not understood at the time, he perceived at last that this was the person to whom he had alluded when affording him a clue to little Rupert's history. He would sit in silence for hours with the child, being no great speaker at the best of times, But the boy, on his part, was too ready with his tongue for any break in discourse to arise, because Timothy Petrick had nothing to say. After idling away his mornings in this manner, Petrick would go to his own room, and swear in long loud whispers, and walk up and down, calling himself the most ridiculous dolt that ever lived, and declaring that he would never go near the little fellow again, to which resolve he would adhere for the space perhaps of a day. Such cases are happily not new to human nature, but there never was a case in which a man more completely befuddled his former self than in this. As the child grew up, Timothy's attachment to him grew deeper, till Rupert became almost the sole object for which he lived. There had been enough of the family ambition latent in him for Timothy Petrick to feel a little envy when, some time before this date, his brother Edward had been accepted by the Honorable Harriet Mountclere, daughter of the second Viscount of that name and title. But having discovered, as I have before stated, the paternity of his boy Rupert, to lurk in even a higher stratum of society, those envious feelings speedily dispersed. Indeed, the more he reflected thereon, after his brother's aristocratic marriage, the more content did he become. His late wife took softer outline in his memory, as he thought of the lofty tastes he had displayed, though only a plain burgher's daughter, and the justification for his weakness in loving the child, the justification that he had longed for was afforded now in the knowledge that the boy was by nature, if not by name, a representative of one of the noblest houses in England. She was a woman of grand instincts, after all, apostrophe he said to himself proudly. To fix her choice upon the immediate successor in that ducal line it was finally conceived. Had he been of low blood like myself, or my relations, she would scarce have deserved the harsh measure that I have dealt out to her and her offspring. How much less, then, when such groveling tastes were farthest from her soul? The man Annetta loved was noble, and my boy is noble in spite of me. ... The afterclap was inevitable, and it soon came. So far, he reasoned, from cutting off this child from inheritance of my estates, as I have done, I should have rejoiced in the possession of him. He is of pure stock on one side at least, whilst in the ordinary run of affairs he would have been a commoner to the bone. Being a man, whatever his faults, of good old beliefs in the divinity of kings and those about him, the more he overhauled the case in this light, the more strongly did his poor wife's conduct in improving the blood and breed of the Petrick family win his heart. He considered what ugly, idle, hard-drinking scamps many of his own relations had been, the miserable scriveners, usurers, and pawnbrokers that he had numbered among his forefathers, and the probability that some of their bad qualities would have come out in a merely corporeal child, to give him sorrow in his old age. Turn. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.